Cruising down the street, I wonder where this road would lead. So many possibilities. Care to share what you think? Oh, noodles, what do you see? Back Road Odyssey.
The Real Salem Road to the Trials. A false tongue will never make a guilty person. Susanna Martin, executed for witchcraft. Salem, Massachusetts, July 19th, 1692. A small shop is filled to the brim with sage, tarot cards, and spell books. Thick incense obscures eager shoppers and visiting tourists. In the bustle, a small book captures your attention. The Witches, Salem, 1692. The story contained within its pages begin not in the bustling modern town of Salem with its shops and attractions, but miles inland in the small house of a pastor. The first accusations of witchcraft are made inside its walls, stoking the fire of communal hysteria, religious zealotry, and ultimately the conviction and execution of 20 individuals. We visit the Dark Stone Foundation, far from the attractions of Salem. We're currently standing at the center of the village parsonage, just outside of Salem, modern Salem. And what's wild is this is so hard to find. To find the now called village parsonage, you must actively look for it. The remains of the one-room building lie tucked between quaint residential houses in Danvers, Massachusetts, formerly known as Salem Village. The road leading to the first accusation made within the parsonage walls is long and requires context. For witchcraft, which is a thing grown very common among us, I know it to be the most abominable sin, and I have been occupied these three quarters of the year for sifting out them that are guilty herein. King James VI of Scotland, 1591. Going back as far as the 14th century, the concept of witchcraft was commonplace across Europe. The belief was that a person, commonly but not exclusively female, would make a diabolical pact with the devil. The witch would then be able to unleash woes, channeling their newfound evil powers upon people of their choosing. Persecutions of these witches surfaced in waves at different times in different places. The Valois trials in France and Switzerland in 1428, the Trier trials in 1580s Germany, and eventually reaching London with the Pendle Hill trials in 1612 and beyond. But interestingly, what was accepted for centuries back in Europe was already fading from the public consciousness by 1690. The events of Salem, then, seem to be the last labored breaths of a tradition of persecution going back centuries. The hysteria at Salem and the violence it brings can only be understood by gaining a better understanding of the community that brought it about. To me, there is nothing more fraught with mystery and terror than a remote Massachusetts farmhouse against a lonely hill. Where else could an outbreak like the Salem witchcraft have occurred? H.P. Lovecraft. Salem Town was part of the original Massachusetts Bay Colony, which was established in 1620. As population increased, settlers moved west to farm the less occupied but rough and rocky New England soil. In 1638, a group of farmers settled in the Danvers Highlands in what was first known as Salem Farms and later as Salem Village. This village, which was located about 5 miles inland from Salem Town, at the coast, grew to become a relatively reclusive community of some 500 by 1690. And as is common in small communities, everyone in Salem Village knows each other in some capacity. What is also common, specifically in this time, in this particular place, people stick to their own. They're prone towards suspicion of others and ultimately will do what it takes to survive. With the onset of King William's War in 1689, a conflict in the regions of upstate New York, Quebec, and Nova Scotia, the movement of refugees southwards, including Salem Village, disrupted the already delicate balance of the community. The growing population, strained, an already tense economic situation, and provoked, an already deeply paranoid people. Paranoid people, limited resources, growing population, strong puritanical traditions, including the belief that God and the devil tangibly affect the world, and what amounted to a theocratical judicial system. What could go wrong? I am not some preaching farmer with a book under my arm. I am a graduate of Harvard College. Samuel Parris. All right, let me describe what I see. The foundation is a collection of dark rocks in the shape of kind of a small rectangle. I'm 6 feet tall, so lying down, I'd probably take up a large amount of the available space on either side of the rectangle. There is, six people living here at the time? Man. There's also a stone staircase leading into what amounts to be a hole. So not much physically. This site is kind of surrounded by suburban houses. It literally could be somebody's backyard. When I stop to think about the legacy of this place, the pain it ended up causing people, the eventual impact it had on all of our collective imagination, that's what makes it one of the most interesting sites in and around Salem, in my experience. Salem Village filters through parishioners faster than most. Some blame tensions within the community. Others credit the location itself as being undesirable. Regardless, Reverend Samuel Parris enters Salem Village in 1689 after a slew of short-lasting parishioners. And Parris was, by most accounts, a greedy and stubborn man. Not entirely respectable qualities when entering the social powder keg of Salem Village. Parris combined evangelical enthusiasm and structural rigidity, which widened the already substantial divides within the Salem Village community. Upon arriving, Reverend Parris essentially made it harder to become a full member of the church, which did two things. One, it elevated the status for full members of the church, who, by extension, supported Parris and his policies. Because remember, this is a community deeply entrenched in rigid Christian theology, unlike Boston or more mercantile communities. And to be respected in the church was to be respected in the village. Secondly, previous full members dissented and then found allies among non-members, who constituted a large amount and influential portion of the Salem Village community. Within 2 years of Parris's arrival, the conditions were perfect for conflict, and as fate would have it, the source of evil would arise not from the house of partial members or deserters, but from the house of the Reverend himself.
It's wild to think everybody knows about the Salem witch trial. Few, including me before I did research, knew what or who really caused it, and the person living inside of this house was a big part of that. And to walk where he walked, where he lived, is truly remarkable. And in the fact that everything stems back to what happened feet around where I'm standing right now.
Many within Salem Village came to believe that the increased conflict was the work of the devil. This would be proven true, in their minds, when in January 1962, Reverend Parris's daughter Elizabeth, age 9, and his niece Abigail Williams, age 11, start to have episodes. Without warning, they would scream, produce sounds, and contort their bodies in strange, seemingly impossible positions. Soon after, another girl, Ann Putnam Jr., age 12, exhibited similar behavior. After some time, when no improvements are shown, the girls are taken to a doctor who, seeing no physical reason for these episodes, cite the supernatural as the main cause of their conditions. Witchcraft is here in Salem Village. This leads to the most consequential baking of a cake in history. Concerned by the diagnosis of the supernatural, likely witchcraft, Mary Sibley, a neighbor of Reverend Paris, recommends the baking of a witch cake. Basically, in what is a well-known folk practice in English culture at the time, a witch cake is a cake or biscuit that is made with rye flour and the urine of the afflicted person, namely one of the girls. The cake was then, naturally, fed to a dog. If the dog exhibits the same symptoms as the ill person, the presence of witchcraft is proven. The dog is then expected to point out the witch or witches that are practicing their evil crafts. The baking of the witch cake, in this case, predictably reveals nothing. But, ironically, it is in the baking of this witch cake, meant to help the problem, where the seeds of paranoia are deeply planted. Reverend Paris denounces the baking of the cake loudly to his congregation, perhaps in a bid to steer suspicion away from himself and his household where the cake was baked in the first place.
You're going to the devil for help against the devil.
This only fueled communal suspicion within Salem Village. It was Tituba, an enslaved Barbados woman to the Paris family, that actually baked the witch cake and fed it to the dog that lived within Paris's household, to dire consequences, sadly. For in the growing witchcraft hysteria brought about by the baking of this witch cake inside the Paris household, the three afflicted girls make the first of many accusations. Two locals, Sarah Good and Sarah Osborne, and the unfortunate Tituba.
I also think about just how powerless people must have felt thinking that they could be next. And as I kept looking into who was accused, as is kind of so often in history, it's usually the people at the fringes of society that fall first. And just deeply feel for all of those who were caught up in the middle of this.
The first three to be accused are not the first to face the gallows. The cracks in Salem society are beginning to show themselves. Bridget Bishop, on her third husband, unliked largely by the community and more outspoken than is desirable for women of the time, was an easy first target. Rumors start to spread that she is the one responsible for the deaths of her first two husbands. Others claim that small items go missing when Bishop is around. All in all, she did not fit in the rigorous social structure enforced in Salem Village. She was brought to trial on June 2nd, convicted of witchcraft, and sentenced to death by hanging. Bridget Bishop is the first to be executed in the summer of 1692. But she would not be the last. The paranoia is just starting. A small stone foundation rests in silence. Cars pass nearby in the gloomy gray light. I walk to the rocky center of the structure. A somber feeling washes over me in the quiet. This is the real Salem, I think to myself. Thank you for listening to Backroad Odyssey. Stay tuned for part two of the trials next week. We'll go over the trials themselves, the progression of paranoia, theories for the hysteria, and finally, the conclusion and legacy of the trials. Until then, feel free to ask questions via my Instagram, Backroad Odyssey, about the trials, van life, or any previous or future episodes. I'll be answering questions this Thursday for Van Life Diaries. Finally, if you find value in the stories that we're telling, please rate, review, and subscribe. Genuinely helps us continue to do what we're doing, continue to grow. Until then, be good to each other. Where to next?
Backroad Odyssey.